So, this afternoon, let's have an even mellower session than normal. You're supposed to laugh. You know, me, just kind of a totally laid-back dude, you know, California hippie, just off the beach, coming in, you know, hanging out. So even more mellow and relaxed and hang loose than normal. Just a couple of footnotes to a very important point from yesterday, and then I'd like to go directly to meditation and really look at the text in more detail today. But this point that is counterintuitive, and it turns out to be, I think, quite a profound truth. I found the quote that I was looking for. I like to get things exact. And this was indeed from, I hope you're here. Oh, there you are. Yep, you're here. This was indeed from Einstein, but not something he wrote, but rather simply a comment that Einstein made to Werner Heisenberg. So when two such people have a conversation, you really like to be a fly on the wall. You know, what do they talk about? You know, what do they talk about? And so this was quoted by Heisenberg in a book that he wrote, but he quotes Einstein in a conversation the two of them had. And Einstein commented to this young fellow, Werner Heisenberg. Einstein said that he first commented that, well, the normal view is, always look for that, because you know they're about to turn it upside down, and that's where it gets interesting, right? The normal view is you make some observations and then you come up with a theory. Right? Everybody knows that, right? Except Einstein. He turned it upside down. He said, but on principle, it is quite wrong to try founding a theory on observable magnitudes alone. In reality, the very opposite happens. It is the theory which decides what we can observe. So I think there's a great, great truth in that. By a person who came up with some of the most brilliant theories in the history of humanity. But the theory, your beliefs, your conceptual framework, that determines what you can see. It's not just photons striking your eyes or, you know, sound waves coming to your eardrums. The theory, there's the statement, actually, it's quoted in Shantideva's Shiksha Samachaya, Compendium of Practices. I quote a sutra, I believe it was, where the gist of it was that the labeling of something, when we say there's Rondo or there's Gachi, the labeling of someone, anything at all, the use of words, illuminates and darkens at the same time. It illuminates that which it's pointing to and then darkens that which it's not pointing to. It throws in its shadows, maybe even to the point of invisibility. You know? And so when we have a theory, evolutionary theory, the brilliant theory of Darwin, which I've admired ever since I heard about it, just can't take it as a religion, of course. At least I don't, many people do. It illuminates certain aspects of our human existence, our drives, our desires, what we're good at, why emotions arise as they do. Very good. I mean, Paul Ekman is just world class in this point, showing how, because he's a great, great believer in Darwin's theory, and himself being a world expert on scientific study of emotions, shows how from our evolutionary past, we are, configured, or have we've evolved to have a certain array of emotions that come up, and why they're useful, how they experience, how we observe them, how we don't observe them. And all of that, that brilliant theory of Darwin, and with this fellow, Alfred Russel Wallace, how it illuminates certain aspects of our existence and throws in complete darkness, makes invisible things that are just not there, like eudaimonia, for example, or the nature of consciousness, for example, or transcendent experiences, for example, or, for that matter, subjective experience altogether. But this is true for all theories, no culture develops evenly. Tibet was just basically had almost no objective quantitative science at all or any corresponding technology. It highlights one, the other thrown in the shadows. Highlight the importance of one, then things that are not that are simply bound to be viewed as less significant. And then a quote by Niels Bohr. So really, given with Heisenberg, Niels Bohr, you're talking about giants of the creators of quantum mechanics, and this is all there is for this afternoon. But here's Niels Bohr from a book that he wrote, and he writes here, and he was the great friendly sparring partner of Albert Einstein. The two were giants, And Albert Einstein, deeply committed to more of metaphysical realism and to his relativity theory. Niels Bohr, very skeptical of metaphysical realism and one of the greatest pioneers of quantum mechanics, and deeply convinced it was on the right path, and Einstein deeply convinced it was inadequate. But a very friendly, not even rivalry so much, but good sparring partners. It was a wonderfully gentlemanly kind of a relationship between the two. Science, scientific dialogue and discourse, I think, at some of its best. So here's Niels Bohr. As our knowledge becomes wider, we must always be prepared, therefore, to expect alterations in the point of view best suited for the ordering of our experience. In this connection, we must remember above all that as a matter of course, all new experience makes its appearance within the frame of our customary points of view and forms of perception. So that earlier theme that we see something a novel, unprecedented, that doesn't fit, and the natural involuntary tendency is to make it make sense within the familiar. And if it doesn't, I've seen this happen so many times, just, well, oh, that's an anomaly, and then not think about it anymore. Ah, that was strange. And then, it's gone, you know. Something that could have challenged your entire worldview, rocked you from the very foundation. Oh, that was an anomaly. And then business as usual. I think it's incredible. So there it is, two giants of modern 20th century physics. And it's nice to share. So in this regard, this will be brief. The Vipassana is designed to deconstruct all of these frameworks, wherever you lie. Most of us, most of the time, are on the side of metaphysical realism. Whether we even know what the word means, that's what we do. And some who see the inadequacies of that, it doesn't deliver the goods, then easily slip over. This happened especially in the 20th century, into this kind of subjective relativism. And so what's left over, of course, in the Madhyamaka view is the Madhyamaka view. Without coming into competition, just showing all of these too, when you follow the consequences, then these frameworks, these perspectives, these conceptual grids by means of which we make sense of reality, they fall away, and the ideal is to transcend all conceptual grids. That's the point. All of them. Even everything you've learned from Madhyamaka, all the Madhyamaka fingers pointing to the moon, eventually you just transcend the fingers. And that means you're transcending all conceptual frameworks and seeing reality as it is, devoid of conceptual elaboration, or drupadandarwa in Tibetan. Yeah. That's just straight Madhyamaka. And that's why it is said, in Prasanga in particular, but more broadly in Madhyamaka, we have no view. We have no view. We're not still operating out of the conceptual grid. Well, it satisfies one of our innermost, most primordial longings, and that is the longing for transcendence. And neurophysiologists try to understand that in terms of the brain, and psychologists try to understand it, and philosophers try to understand it. And scientists have been following that course since Galileo, if not before. How to transcend this little goldfish bowl of the world as it looks like from our own perspective. A Mexican perspective, a German perspective, a California perspective. And just kind of wishing, you know, there's something more, isn't there something outside? Couldn't I somehow get beyond this anthropocentricity, this human-centered view? And as I mentioned before, that was a primary motive for Galileo, wanted to see reality, to approximate the view of reality from God's own perspective, you know? And they did that since Galileo by looking outwards, and by looking outwards by way of refined senses with technology, and of course this very subtle conceptual grid called mathematics. And we see the result, fantastic success in some respects, and yet no more insight in the nature of consciousness now than they had during the time of Galileo. But the brilliance of people like John Wheeler and Stephen Hawking and so forth, to go that far by looking outwards, and conceptual, Roger Penrose, another one, the fact that these are some of the greatest we've had in recent history, and they've gone so far, is truly awesome. Truly awesome. But it winds up with a view. It's still a view. whether it's string theory, it's, you know, it's quantum cosmology, whatever, it's still a view. It's still locked in a grid, which means it's highlighting some things and throwing other things into the dark. And what is missing there in that whole trajectory, from Galileo up right up to Stephen Hawking, who's still alive and well, coming up with more brilliant ideas as the months go by, what's still lacking is the actual transcendence beyond the conceptual grid. Right? Well, for this, sooner or later, you need to actually transform your mind and not simply your intellect. And so we transcend this kind of anthropocentric view, of course, by dissolving your human mind, so it's no longer operative, down into the substrate consciousness, which is not human. That's a pretty big transcendence. But it's still from a sentient being-centric, a sentient being-centric, still from the perspective of a person who's locked into dualistic grasping. It's soft, it's quiet, it's blissful, because it's so nice to have the symptoms subdued, but it's still the perspective of a sentient being. And to cut through that to pristine awareness, at that point, all these wonderful quotes from extremely insightful, intelligent, brilliant people now are irrelevant. They no longer hold. When you're viewing reality from the perspective of Rigpa, none of that's true. It doesn't block, it doesn't augment, it doesn't filter, it doesn't configure. It's raw, it's naked, and it's indivisible from Dharma Dhatu. And so, in this Buddhist context, this is where we should be. Everybody came for a Buddhist retreat. This has been a Buddhist retreat. You might have noticed that the conceptual framework for the practice itself takes you beyond the conceptual framework. But when we start talking about the context for the ineffable, the inconceivable, the context we're using, of course, is a Buddhist one. Fair enough. If this were a Christian retreat, focusing on, let's say, from Nicholas of Cusa, John Scotus Eriugena from the 8th century through Nicholas of Cusa of the 15th century, that's 700 years, that's not bad, then the practices could be the same, but the way of articulating them would be very different. The context would be different. So that yearning, I think it is universal. I think it is timeless. I think it's not just human. That yearning for transcendence, that drew the scientists looking for a God's eye view, that drew Christian contemplatives for wanting the ascent to the direct encounter with the mind of God, and we see it everywhere. This is the response from this current, from this flow, from this path, is when you break through to Rigpa, then you are fulfilling your eternal longing. And then we can ask, where does that eternal longing come from? Rigpa. Where else could it possibly coming from? That could not be coming from outside. And it's not just coming from your mind. It's not coming from biology or evolution or genetic mutation. It's deeper than all of that. And so, that's the practice. Extremely useful on the relative level. But sooner or later, if we're ready to be free and to satisfy that eternal longing, we use it like a carriage, like a vehicle, Shravaka vehicle, Mahayana vehicle, Vajrayana, and then you take the vehicle to where you want to go and you get out of the vehicle. That's simple. That was very straightforward. No big drama. Okay? So let's practice. Please find a very comfortable posture. And as you're settling in this afternoon, we'll do something again, structure, a tiny bit novel, content not novel at all. This will be another combination plate, and this time you'll know immediately what I'm referring to when I use the shorthand. It will be balancing wind and space. I like to do this, you know what it means then. We'll begin, after settling body, speech, and mind, we'll begin with the settling the mind in its natural state for the first half. So just kind of keep on coming back, deepening the familiarization, the acquaintance with the practice. And then we'll shift, because I'd like to see as clearly as you can, how are these two practices different? One is taking the mind as the path, culminating in shamatha, and the other one is simply resting in not doing. How are those two different? We can talk about it, or we can just do it, and then you'll know the taste in the difference of the two methods. begin by settling body, speech, and mind in the natural states, and for a couple of minutes, gently soothe and calm the discursive mind with mindfulness of breathing. Now, with your eyes gently open, your gaze vacant, settle your mind in its natural state. we settle the mind in its natural state, we seek to deactivate the coarse mind by releasing all identification with it and simply observing it from a deeper space, our best approximation of the substrate consciousness, which allows the awareness to descend to that perspective. And now we release even further. Release all doing, release all activation of the samsaric mind that's entrenched in dualistic grasping. Thus release all desire, all striving, all modifications, and all doing. And simply rest your awareness in the present moment, wide open, free of distraction to appearances, free of grasping to the mind.
recall that generally in this practice, the first phase is cutting through. Mokata. Cutting through to the essential nature of the original purity of pristine awareness itself. Utterly transcendent, beyond all conceptual frameworks. As you rest there, without doing anything, then it becomes increasingly apparent that all appearances in the space of the mind, appearances in all of the senses, are nothing other than displays of this dimension of awareness, pristine awareness. And you know from that perspective that all these appearances are empty. Their essential nature is empty, their manifest nature is luminosity, and they are all expressions in your mandala, for you, of all pervasive compassion. All appearances arise to lead you along the way to your complete awakening.
So just to reiterate one point, and that's for those following a path, let's say the Sutrayana path, where you're cultivating relative bodhicitta, you know, and in that context, ultimate bodhicitta, simply realization of emptiness, right? Very straightforward. And neither one of those is completely balanced.
method without wisdom is bondage, wisdom without method is bondage. In that context, when you are, how do you say, when an Arya Bodhisattva goes into a conceptually unmediated, non-dual realization of emptiness, then that's going into the space-like meditative equipoise, and there's just no appearances. There's no appearances because the conceptual designation process has completely shut down, and appearances don't arise. In this view, the appearances don't arise without conceptual designation. There are no objects in your world, and so as you're dwelling as an Arya Bodhisattva in that meditative equipoise, there is only emptiness, and your eyes can be open, doesn't matter. There is only emptiness, right? Then you emerge from your meditative equipoise, you're in the post-meditative state, and then it's called gyumataputingensen, so illusion-like samadhi, as you're engaging, doing everything you need to do. Maybe you're teaching, maybe you're president of a university, who knows what you're doing. You're doing what you need to do, but the meditation in between sessions is viewing all phenomena, kind of milam tabur, as if they were dreams. Like dreams, this is like a dream, like a dream. And if you're lucid in a dream, you know that there's nothing there. Not if an asteroid is coming towards planet Earth, there is nothing there from its own side. Now you could be in a dream and an asteroid can come and hit your Earth and can kill everybody in your dream. Yeah, you could shoot ballistic missiles at it and atomic bombs at it and so forth, and you still get wiped out and then you wake up, you know? So it's dreamlike, dreamlike. And then you go back deep into meditative equipoise, in and out. Well, the difference between that path and this path is you're not simply resting in meditative equipoise in emptiness, but you're resting in this view, of course, in pristine awareness. And there is such a thing as meditative equipoise. You're just resting there and you're not doing anything at all, but then you do come out. You do come out. But to the best of your ability, even when you come out, you're not doing anything. That is, you may be like a Dingu Kenzo Rinpoche or Dujun Rinpoche, enormously active, but as a sentient being, you're not doing anything at all. There is no activation of any sentient being's mind, right? And so, but the point I really wanted to say, I'll make it very quickly, is that as a Vidyadhara, having rested in Rigpa, and you may rest in Rigpa. Just in that utterly transcendent mode. And then when you emerge, though, and there are all these appearances, you view these appearances not as if they were a dream. From that perspective, you view them as a dream. So it seems like, oh, that's just a little difference in terminology. And yeah, it's enormous, it's a cosmic difference. One is like a dream, and the other one is from the perspective of the awakened mind, this is a dream. Awake, dream, you remember awake, awake means awake, not dreaming, so this is a dream. But it's a dream that is 100% sacred space. It's not a dream of samsara, not for you. You could be drinking tea with somebody in the same, across the table, and they're in samsara. But wherever you are, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't, you can be in a hell realm. You could be in a deva realm and anything in between. Where you are, this is sacred space. Because you're resting in Rigpa. And so everything that is arising to you, you see it. You don't imagine it. You imagine it in doing state of generation practice. Right? But here you don't imagine anything. That's the nature of Dzogchen. You're simply resting in pristine awareness. So all appearances arise and you see them. You view them as empty of inherent nature. You have no choice. Of course they're empty. Why? They're empty. That's why. There's no logic. It's just, they're empty, but their manifest nature, of course, is one of luminosity. But it's not just a light show with you in the center of that mandala. It's not just a bunch of empty appearances, cool, psychedelic. There's something very special about these appearances for you in the center of your mandala. And all these appearances, without exception, never stronger, never weaker, all these appearances are nothing but appearances of Dharmakaya. That is manifestations of Dharmakaya, appearing in forms, appearing as sound, Sambhogakaya, appearing as forms to all of the five senses, as Nimanakaya, and the whole, so that phrase, reality rising up to meet you, well, now it's the tap is fully on. All appearances at all times, while awake, dreaming, and asleep, all appearances are homogeneously, infinitely arising to bring you to full awakening. So really, sacred space, every entire sacred. There's nothing there that is not divine. Not because you're not because you're imagining a yidam or imagining divine pride or imagining anything at all. That's how things appear. So let's get a glimpse. What do people continue to report from that experience, and how might their words somehow draw us in that direction? Because it sounds like a very good direction to go to. We're on top of page 131. The tantra of inborn inconceivability, or conate inconceivability, states, since that which is conate is free of conceptual elaboration, that is, you're born with it, he's referring, of course, to pristine awareness, there is nothing on which to meditate. Do not interrupt the flow of the objectless nature. Okay, clear. Then we're back to the Sutrayana. Non-mental, that is from the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in 100,000 stanzas, states non-mental engagement. This is mentation, that manas, remember that? Non-mental engagement is going for refuge in the Buddha. Well, non-mental engagement is not activating your samsaric mind. Resting in pristine awareness without activating the samsaric mind, that's the final taking refuge, which of course is taking refuge in your own pristine awareness. The great Brahman Saraha says, once you have seen your own mind free of conceptual elaboration, contemplation in which you ceaselessly produce elaborations is like searching for a glass trinket after you have found a precious gem. So once you've cut through to pristine awareness, if you come out of that feeling, well, that was good, but I better get back to my vipassana, I better get back to my stage of generation or stage of completion. You're walking backwards. Why would you going there? The whole point of all of that, from Shravakayana through the Mahayana through all the way through stage of generation completion, was to get you there. So don't look back over your shoulder. Stay there. This will take you the rest of the way. He says again, and there is nothing on which to meditate. Bring nothing to mind. Do not contaminate the primordial natural state of ordinary consciousness with structured objects, for the mind that is inherently pure is in no need of modification. I trust this is getting kind of more and more familiar. Nothing jars, nothing like, what? It kind of flows, doesn't it? It's kind of getting more and more familiar. But phrasing it in this bouquet is giving us a very, very rich bouquet here. Phrasing it a bit differently here, a bit different there. Each time it's softening up, giving some, stirring something that may eventually come to flower. Oh yeah. Shavaripa makes a similar comment in Virupa, one of the great Mahasiddhas of India, very seminal for the Sakya tradition. He states, without thinking of existence or non-existence, rest in non-distraction. Bringing to mind nothing at all, even the absence of extremes, is to fail. Bringing to mind anything at all, even the absence of extremes, is to fail to abide in the reality of the nature of existence, and it is a great distraction. So they're showing, don't backslide here, don't go back to Madhyamaka, don't go back. Rest here. I mean, it's so tempting to think, oh, but I should be doing something. I'm not fully enlightened yet, I have to do something. And the answer is, no, you don't. Stop, and let the rest happen of its own accord. Tilopa says, you do not see the intellect transcending reality of that which transcends the intellect, which is the nature of the intellect. You do not see that reality which is of the nature of the intellect. Is emphasizing once again this whole theme of pristine awareness and the displays of pristine awareness. The displays of pristine awareness are nothing other than pristine awareness, right? And so the intellect is a display of pristine awareness, so it's not other than. This is the whole theme of Rigpa and the Rigpa Tsel, the displays of Rigpa. You do not realize the reality of inactivity, which is the nature of activity. Okay, it's nice, but this is now getting more and more familiar. the full moon, which we'll have in, what, down up 12 days or so, something like that. The full moon, it's going to be a super moon. The full moon, cloudless night, and somebody starts filling their swimming pool. Is the moon active or not when suddenly there's an appearance there which wasn't there before? And it came from the moon, right? If there were no moon, it wouldn't be here. And so was the moon active or not active in that? And moreover, you see it has causal efficacy. That's the interesting part, I find, is that you look at it and you can take a photo of it. And yet, of course, if you're looking into the... Okay, now a little test. You ready for a little test? Okay, you're looking in the swimming pool, or a pond, let's say a pond is nicer. A pond, you're looking into a pond, nice glassy surface, and then, oh, this beautiful, perfect reflection. You're looking down there, let's say at 45 degree angle. Oh, look at that beautiful reflection of the moon, so full, super moon. Wow. Where are your eyes focused as you're looking into the water, which is about 15 feet away, or let's say, okay, 8 meters away, whatever, no, 5 meters away. Okay, the water's right over there, and you're looking down at the moon, and there's that perfect image. It just, you look up at the sky, and then look down, say, that's the same. This water's so pure, so still. The reflection's kind of like perfect, right? And you're looking down into the water, and you see the reflection of the moon. How far... And not Claudio, how far away your eyes, where are your eyes focused? Where are your eyes focused?
5 meters.
Okay, there's 5 meters. Five meters beyond, that's a possibility. Any other? So let's say the moon is 237,000 miles away. I know miles better than kilometers. That's, if you look up there, and if you could actually calibrate where your eye is focusing, it would say 237,000 miles. So that's when you look up at the sky, way up there. But now you're looking down here, and the water is just 5 meters away. So now you're looking down here, and the moon comes into focus, right? So how far away are your eyes focused now?
Same,
yeah, 237,000 miles away. And you can check it. You can check it. Use a camera lens. This is not hypothetical. This is crank the camera lens. Anybody who knows optics knows this. It's commonplace, but it's incredibly weird. That your eyes tell you, your retina tells you, the camera lens tells you, the image that you're focusing on, which is now in focus. If you and you can try this, I encourage you, if you have any doubt about this, or you just like to see for yourself, focus your camera. You know the old-fashioned kind that says 10 meters, 20 meters, and so forth? Crank it around and focus on the surface of the water. And what you'll get is the surface of the water will be in very sharp focus, and the image of the moon will be totally out of focus. Especially, well, again, the story from my background is Germany, 1970. Did I tell it already? No? I did, yeah? Here? Okay, it's short. But I was kind of into photography, and I had an old-fashioned, you know, camera back then, single lens reflex with film, remember those? The dinosaurs used them, and then we human beings got to use them. Something like that. And so in any case, it was a beautiful sunny day outside of Göttingen. I was out in the forest, and there was a pond, and the pond had this beautiful moss on the edge, just gorgeous, that radiant green. It was springtime, I think. And the pond was perfectly still, and had this beautiful reflection of the trees on the far side of the pond. And I wanted to do kind of an artistic shot, you know? And so I could see, just it was so clear, it was like a mirror. And I thought, I know what I'd like to do. I'd like to take a photo of the reflection of the trees on the far shore, maybe 10 meters away. It wasn't a very big pond. But I'm looking down here at the reflections of the trees which are up there, and I'd like to get the reflection of the trees in focus, but I'd like to border the photo of the reflections with the moss. Kind of just moss, like a frame, you know? I thought that would be kind of cool. Okay. So I'd never done this before, and so, but that means I'm coming right down to the water. I'm coming like only like 1 foot, or half, even just maybe half a meter away from the water. I'm coming quite close, because I want to really frame the reflections I can see right there, right in front of me, with the moss around. And that's when I had my startle, is that to get, when I focused on the trees, I was focusing at, let's say, 15 meters, and the moss was totally out of focus. And then if you get the moss in focus, of course you can, the trees are totally out of focus. That was like, oh, I didn't see that coming. But now you come back there, just because it's, they use this phrase a lot. Maybe they want us to dwell on it a bit. You're looking down there, as Hosea said, you're looking down there, you're looking right down into the earth, right? And you're looking and you're focusing on something that a camera lens will tell you, yes, it's there. I got a photo of it. Here's my photo. It was there. This is a machine. I just took a photo with a machine, and it's physical. And here's my photo. And the photo is of something 237,000 miles away this way. Is there anything there? 237,000 miles, that is through the earth, on the far side? Of course not. And yet, that's where the image is, and it has causal efficacy. It's white. It's an empty appearance. And the moon did that. But how much effort was it on the part of the moon? Right? And then you can cover over, you could cement over the pond. People do that. And then there's no more image. So does the moon go, phew, that's one less, I can rest a little bit. One less one I have to, no, of course not. No effort, spontaneous, empty, luminous, and it's also quite beautiful. So there we go. Shavadipa, another Mahasiddha, says, in Mahamudra, in which nothing is brought to mind, there is not the slightest thing on which to meditate, so do not meditate. The supreme meditation is inseparable from the reality of no meditation. Now, these are called secret teachings, because you can imagine if you go to, just go out and you start a little meditation center, and you just read that. Hello, everybody. Welcome. Please put your $20 there. Thank you very much. Okay, everybody, thank you. Thank you for paying. Good, thank you. Okay, here it is. So the supreme meditation is non-meditation. Thank you very much. You can go home now. I mean, the ways of misinterpreting this, if you don't have the context, are enormous, right? And so that's why context is so important. Let's keep on going. Oh, yeah, the synthesized word states here on page 132, without modifying its nature, leave it in its natural state. The absence of thought is the Dharmakaya. Well, now you know it. It's not just sitting there like, you know, stoned or, you know, vegetative. You know it now. It's absence of thought because pristine awareness transcends all conceptual elaboration. That's Dharmakaya, which is devoid of conceptual elaboration. If you let it be without seeking, that is meditation, whereas seeking and meditating entails deluded mental activity. It's still operating out of the dualistic mind. Another one, back to Nagpopa. Whatever is realized with the intellect is a realization that is no realization. This is like, this phrase is, it's a very ancient book. Maybe Elizabeth knows when it was written. The Cloud of an Unknowing. It's very old. 7th century, 7th, 9th, yeah. It's old. Yeah, it's way old. It's one of the great classics from the Christian mystical tradition, the Neoplatonic. The Cloud of Unknowing. And that is, and I'm not going to try to equate the two. It's just when I see a resonance, it's okay to talk about a resonance. That from the perspective of Rigpa, all of our knowledge, including quantum cosmology and Wittgenstein and Darwin and DNA, it's unknowing. It's ignorance. It's delusion. It's datura. But from the perspective of a person who may be, you know, brilliant and extremely well informed of this phenomenal world, Rigpa seems like you don't know anything at all. You don't even have a view. You can't even talk about it. And you can't even think about it. If you can't talk about it and you can't think about it, then you don't know anything worth knowing. So on both sides, it's kind of like, you know. Each side looks like it's in the dark from the other side. The absence of thought is the Dharmakaya. If you let it be without seeking, that is meditation, whereas seeking and meditating entails deluded mental activity. Why? Because you're activating your samsaric mind. And that's perpetuating in the cycle. That's like doing all kinds of brilliant things. New creations, like being a Nikola Tesla, one brilliant invention after another, one brilliant theory after another, all within the context of a non-lucid dream.
but you're still not lucid, which means fundamentally you're delusional. And he adds, if one cuts through too, this is very interesting, if one cuts through too strongly with the essence of primordial consciousness, this becomes a problem for insight. By the way, I strongly encourage you read Gyatro Rinpoche's commentary here. It's very, very helpful. And so if one cuts through too strongly, and that is if you overemphasize without having spent sufficient time in Vipassana, really breaking down the reification, and not just stopping the reification, but seeing through it, seeing, actually ascertaining the emptiness of appearance. If you've done that insufficiently, because it's hard work and it's disturbing and that takes the mind, raises a lot of qualms and questions and like that, and then you're introduced to non-meditation, so, oh, I like this much better. I like this much, much better. Oh, yes, 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 yes. Ah, good, 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 good. Well, then if you cut through to that too much, then actually that may impede, because you may be doing a mere facsimile. And that's ever so easy to happen. Nowadays, when people say, I'm resting in Rigpa, resting in Rigpa, maybe they are. Maybe they're just resting in a very complacent dualistic mind that's not very activated, which means it's not shamatha and it's not vipassana and it sure is not rigpa. And that happens very easily. This is why I found especially Dujom Lingbas or Padmasambhava, by way of Dujom Lingba, the clarification between the substrate consciousness and rigpa. It's very possible there are many texts that bring the same clarity. I just don't know. What I do know is in those revealed teachings of Dujom Lingba, boy, it is razor sharp. If you've understood what he said, remember, understanding, experience, realization, and acquiring confidence. If you've understood what he says, he really gives you protection so that you won't prematurely say, ah, good, I'm resting in Rigpa. When maybe you're just resting, you haven't even gotten to the substrate yet. You haven't even gotten there yet, you know. You haven't even settled your mind in its natural state. It's just kind of like, oh, yeah. And your dualistic mind says, oh, good, I'll catch you later. And as soon as you're activated, it's just the same old, same old. You haven't even overcome the five obscurations. Or you've achieved shamatha. One story of one person who achieved shamatha. This was, I think, quite a long time ago. Oh, it was a long time ago. Trying to remember the name of the one of the great gurus, one of the great jut masters. But in any case, his disciple achieved shamatha. And his teacher was a great, great master, tremendous clairvoyance. And the disciple received teaching from the instructor, the teacher. And then came back a long time later to his teacher. And the teacher said, well, what happened? He kind of dropped out of touch. No email, no cell phone. What's up? Whatever, you know. And the disciple said, well, I achieved shamatha. Yeah. And the teacher said, yeah, but what did you do then? I enjoyed it. And then the teacher burst into tears. Oh, then you missed the whole point. You're just resting, like that. Substrate conscious, going nowhere at all. Not even one hair's breadth further along the path. So Kamalashila, back to Sutrayana. Kamalashila, the great disciple of Chandrarakshita, the great debater with the Chinese Hoshang. Kamalashita says, thinking all phenomena are ultimately devoid of an inherent nature, and pondering no inherent nature exists at all, is to abandon genuine wisdom. With respect to such an object that transcends existence and non-existence, consciousness also transcends existence and non-existence. Meditate like that without an object. Now here's a great scholar, formidable scholar. And what he's showing here is the sequence. There's a time for learning, studying his own text, the bhavana krama, the stages of meditation. It goes shamatha, vipassana, step by step. Very good, brilliant work, still a classic. His Holiness teaches it quite frequently. And so many others, right? And knowing there's a time for, you know, really focusing on ethics, a time for shamatha, time for vipassana, that hearing, thinking, and meditation. But once you've cut through, once you've actually gotten the taste, you're in the flow, you've gotten to realization, not just understanding or experience, but you've gotten to realization, then don't go back. Don't walk backwards and grab onto some concepts and be telling yourself, no inherent nature at all. It's like, shut up. We're playing music here. We're in a flow here. Don't contaminate by walking backwards into kind of conceptualizing it and letting the samsaric mind try to own it. You know, don't do that. Don't do that. Nobu Lingba, Dewe Dorje says, if you recognize the clear light, there is no need for reasonings concerning unity and multiplicity. That's one of the pairs in the conceptual eight extremes of conceptual elaboration. In the direct perception of the appearance of great bliss, there is no need to seek out textual citations or inferences. That is, you don't look outside for validation. This is one of those things that when you actually tap into Rigpa, the very important point here, when you actually tap into Rigpa, you're viewing reality from Rigpa, you need absolutely no outside validation. The certainty is so sharp, so utterly definitive, that you just don't need anything outside, right? So you don't need to check, on the one hand. On the other hand, people who are meditating, maybe receive teaching in Dzogchen, they meditate, it is very easy to slip into a state of open presence, or vacuity, or bliss, or luminosity, and think you've realized Rigpa, and you haven't. You may be just getting some kind of luminosity and stillness before even achieving shamatha. Just that's the luminosity and stillness of your conventional dualistic mind, not even that of shamatha. Or you may be tapping into the stillness of the substrate, the luminosity of the substrate consciousness. That's cool, that's not Rigpa. Or you may be gaining some realization of emptiness. That's cool, but that's not Rigpa. And so there's an asymmetry here. You may slip into a state of awareness that you feel as Rigpa, you sense as, you intuit as Rigpa, and you're completely wrong. But if you do slip into Rigpa, you can't the certainty coming out of that cannot possibly be wrong. This is where the guru comes in. Where the guru comes in. That you check, you report. And what the guru doesn't do is just listen to your words and then look at the text and yeah, you should be okay. Because the words are so similar. Really. The words, I mean, how many, we only have so many words. And after a while, the same words get used again and again and again. This word selwa, well, that's vividness, that's in shamatha. A selwa, that's the luminosity of the substrate consciousness. Selwa, that's clear light. And it's selwa, it's just selwa, it's really easy to say. And tomba, empty. Well, yeah, but we have an empty pot. My glass is empty. Hey, fill up my glass, like that. And so you're using these words again and again and again. And they're the same words. They don't have a special terminology, really. Even Rigpa, which is just mean cognition. There it is, And Yeshe, primordial consciousness. Yeah, but it just means knowing, depending on context. Right. So this is where the guru is there needed to help save you some time. When you get there, you won't need that. The guru is your pristine awareness. But until then, it can help to have some sounding board to be able to check in. Oh yeah, let's go on. Oh yeah. Since experience is of the nature of reality, there's no need for a nihilistic view. Since one does not think that is with respect to anything, there is no need for conceptual superimposition. So he just pointed out how to avoid the two extremes. Namgye Dorje says, if you recognize the clear light, there is no need for meditations on the two types of identitylessness. This classic sutrayana, personal identitylessness, phenomenal identitylessness, incredibly important, not now. Even that, not now. You don't need to go back and meditate on emptiness. If you're viewing reality from the perspective of pristine awareness, emptiness is free. It comes with the territory. A commentary to the Dohas, which is translated by Bharochana, states, turning away from the intellectual authentic view, I assert the intended meaning of the Buddha to be the view of recollective awareness and ideation. Both appearances and emptiness are adventitious and are therefore fabricated. Okay, again, moving beyond all conceptual frameworks. Chilopa says, without representing, without thinking, without meditating, and without analyzing, the mind remains in its own nature. That one's clear. Now we're back to Padmasambhava. My eyes always light up. Oh boy, what do you have to say? Because he always, something special. Here he is.
Merely having awareness pointed out as before and knowing your own nature is not enough. Okay, quick analogy. This is from Natural Liberation, which I translated. It's not enough to become lucid in a dream or have a whole bunch of lucid dreams. It's not enough. That's where dream yoga comes in. Once you're lucid, now what? Now thoroughly fathom the reality that you're experiencing. But just peeking in once in a while, that's not going to do it. As an analogy, due to letting one's wild stallion roam freely for many years, its owner will not recognize it. It is not enough for the owner to recognize the horse once it is pointed out to him by a herdsman. Methods must be used to capture the wild stallion, then subdue it and put it to work. Likewise, it is not enough simply to identify this wild mind. It is said, at this time, when the transitional process of meditative stabilization is appearing to me, the delusive multitudes of distractions have been cast off, and without wavering and without grasping, I shall enter into the domain that is free of extremes. Okay? I think it's pretty clear. The transitional process of meditation, of gom, is one of the six bardos that are the topic of natural liberation. Beginners must practice and meditate with unwavering mindfulness. He means, of course, during and between formal meditation sessions. When the wild stallion is not subdued, it must be trained with unwavering enthusiasm. If you waver, you'll lose control of the horse, fall down, and hurt yourself. Which is to say exactly on that the first of the four yogas, single-pointed yoga. When you're in, it's cool. When you're out, you easily fall back into revocation. And then you've fallen off your horse. You're right back operating out of the samsaric mind once again. Likewise, if beginners pursue ordinary thoughts, they fall right back into that rut. They will descend to miserable states of existence and will be hurt. So sustain your meditation with unwavering mindfulness. And again from the same text, Padmasambhava says, without meditating on anything, simply without wavering, let your awareness be steady, luminous, and even. When he says, let your awareness, he says, don't make it do that. That's what happens when you don't do anything. You're not trying to cultivate stillness, luminosity, and equality. That's what's left when you're not doing anything. First practice in short sessions, and as you become accustomed to it, practice in longer and longer sessions. When you bring the session to an end, do not get up abruptly, but rise slowly without losing the sense of meditating. And proceed without losing the sense of awareness, without wavering, and without grasping. That phrase keeps on coming up. Without losing the sense of awareness, of course, he's talking about a person who's cut through to pristine awareness. You come out because you need some food, or need to pick up your mail, whatever. Don't start viewing reality from any other perspective from the one you were just viewing from. Get off, do whatever it needs to do. But now it's right back to seven-point mind training. Be an illusory being. Not moving, not doing anything. Continuing to the view, your post box, from the perspective of pristine awareness, right? Without doing anything. Rise slowly without losing your perspective of pristine awareness and without wavering, without being distracted off, carried away by appearances and reification, and without grasping onto anything from your own side. As you eat, drink, speak, and engage in every activity, do so without losing the century of unwavering mindfulness. Now you know in this context, and boy, this gets really overlooked a lot, when people start speaking of mindfulness and vipassana and then dzogchen, they say, yes, it's all the same. I mean, this is what Jodhkam is in taught. There's nothing new. This is really cool. John Kabat-Zinn, and he's a sweet man. There's no criticism of him at all, or anything he says, or at least not most of what he says. We differ on some points. That's okay. But when it says unwavering mindfulness, you know, we're talking about many stories up from just eat your raisin mindfully, walk mindfully, be here nigh. That's very nice. It's very good. But if you're dreaming that you're practicing Dzogchen, you're not practicing Dzogchen. You're just having a really sweet dream. Because that's not Dzogchen at all. There's no view there. There's no view at all. There's no vipassana, and there's no shamatha. It's a false facsimile. But There's a lot of cutting corners nowadays. So when he says unwavering mindfulness, he's talking about don't get off your throne. Remain in Rigpa at all times. Remain in Dharmakaya all the time. That is, one cannot say strongly enough how far away that is from just, I am really mindful. That's sweet. I'm glad you are. Good. But please don't use the word Dzogchen. If this happens in meditative equipoise, but not afterwards, by integrating this with your spiritual practice and all activities of moving, walking, lying down, and sitting, whatever you do will arise as meditation. You see now the immense gravitas of that statement. When he says everything arises as meditation, he's saying everything is arising. Appearances are all arising as nimanakaya. All sounds as sambhogakaya. All mental activity as dharmakaya. It's sacred space. You're viewing reality from the perspective of a Buddha. How different is that from your just ordinary dualistic mind being mindful from here and there? You know, it cannot be more different. Although, at the same time, I want to say now just praise. This is one of the real strengths of this modern Vipassana movement, the mindfulness movement, that they really do try to bring in kind of a meditative quality, or let's say just a mindful quality, as they're eating and they're walking and they're doing mundane things. And they really try to be very present, very mindful, very attentive, and not just, oh, I meditate, now it's finished, and then they go off and do something else. That's a real strength. The walking meditation, the mindful eating and so forth, this is really good. It's really good. I really respect it. And if they simply don't exaggerate what they're doing by saying this is Vipassana, which it's not, or that it's Mahamudra Dzogchen, which it's not, frankly, with no context, I don't see any reason to call that Zen. With no context at all, you're just eating mindfully and just sitting there. If there are, then there are a heck of a lot of marmots that are practicing Zen. I don't think so. So this is pop Zen, pop Dzogchen, pop Mahamudra, pop Vipassana. I'm not so impressed. But it's better than robbing little old ladies of their purses. Better than something. Oh yeah. So the Tantra of the Synthesized Mysteries of Avalokiteshvara says, with a balanced degree of tension and relaxation. Ever heard of that before? Like a dynamic equilibrium? Ring a bell? With a balance, oh, he said the word that balance. How nice, I like that word. With a balanced degree of tension and relaxation, meditate on the empty state free of conceptual elaboration. It's called settling your mind in its natural state. To the greatest depths. Right? And from the same text, first, like placing a looped rope in water. Frankly, I just have to say, I looked in the comment. I don't see why I use that one. I don't know. I don't really know. But a looped rope in water, okay, maybe that will come up in your meditation. Let me know. I just say I don't understand that. But I'm not losing any sleep over it either. First, like placing a looped rope in water, firm up your posture and awareness to a suitable degree. And in that state, gently relaxed. Oh, yeah, that sounds so familiar. That balance. Right after that, rest in fresh, stable, present, lucid openness. That tension gives rise to clarity, and the relaxation gives rise to steadiness and a degree of joy. Doesn't that sound familiar? Yeah? Resting in a state of freshness gives rise to emptiness and a primordial absence of focus. That is, your mind is not targeting something. Entering into this state in a single session and with a single gaze is said to be unmistaken meditation of the kind the Buddha intended, or the kind the Buddha had in mind. Meditate like that for a long time. If ideation proliferates, concentrate. Now here's an anomaly. It really caught my attention. And it's not a mistranslation, because there you can see in the commentary. If clarity decreases, relax. Now, you remember shamatha? If the clarity decreases, what do? Arouse. Yeah, arouse. Hey, you're spacing out. Hey, wake up. Refresh. Restore. Retain. Right? But on the other hand, if you fall into excitation, then relax. Release. Return. You know that. Our little mantras. Look what he says here. If clarity decreases, relax. If clarity decreases, relax. Release all grasping to the lack of clarity. If you release all grasping to the lack of clarity, you are aware of the dullness with radiant clarity, and there's no need to fix it. Most importantly, rest naturally when there is no problem. At that time, in terms of awareness, the essence is empty lucidity, the manifest nature is unmediated luminosity, and the display is undirected openness. Remain in the single state of luminosity, awareness, and emptiness, and that is pristine awareness, of course. Remain in the single state, that one unified, that one non-dual state of luminosity, pristine awareness, and emptiness. This is flawless Mahamudra. So the Tantra state, meditate in a state of emptiness free of conceptual elaboration. Olasu. So a little tiny story, and then we'll call it a break. This whole thing of just resting, so deeply resting, letting go of all grasping, so that when thoughts flow, they just kind of, they rise and they flow right on through, like being in a room with two windows, and the breeze flows in from one window, just flows right out through the other window. It reminds me of a very pleasant and very brief encounter I had a long time ago, 15, 16 years ago. I was teaching in Santa Barbara, but I taught in the university, but I also gave Dharma talks. I was teaching natural liberation, for example, back then. And that, 80 people or so from the community would come. I would teach once a week on Wednesday nights. They were called the Wednesday night talks. And one evening, at the end of the lecture, a person came up, and as soon as he came up, I think I've seen your face before. I didn't say anything, but he came up just to greet me at the end. And I said, hello, Alan. My name's David Crosby. And David Crosby is one of the most famous and outstanding rock and roll musicians, especially of the 60s, the 70s. Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And he was born in Los Angeles. And he was raised in Santa Barbara. He went to middle school there. He went to high school there. He actually went to Santa Barbara City College. And so he's a Santa Barbaran. And then, this was just 15 years ago or so, he was living right in that area. So he came to a couple of my Dharma talks. And so he introduced himself once. And I've, since I was in my teens, college age, I've really enjoyed their music. Just personal. I just like it. I like their music a lot. It's just really sweet, good old-fashioned rock and roll. And so he came up and he introduced himself and said, and I said, yes, I know who you are. And I just want to express my appreciation for your music. It's brought a lot of joy to a lot of people. Simple thing. And his response, I've remembered ever since. And he said, I just try to get out of the way. And so on that note, let's kind of pause for a moment, turn into the Fantasy Channel, and see what happens when David Crosby gets out of the way. Can you increase the volume? Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
all generation. The lyrics are actually very touching, and they are posted. They're available. It was a little bit hard to understand, but you read the lyrics, they're worth reading. Very touching, very touching. Oh yeah, enjoy your evening. Good night.